What would it be like to have your home demolished by a natural catastrophe, then to receive back an entirely new one without cost? Would you feel entitled to the replacement, or appreciative and grateful? Her relief and development handout tells the story of Emmanuel and his family from Haiti, whose home crumbled into dust with the massive earthquake. All their belongings were lost. There was no community support. They gathered sticks, plastic, and cloth to make a crude, flimsy shelter, the one you see on the left in the photo. They were later chosen by EMCC for help from the Homes for Haiti Fund. It says, "The smile on Madame Emmanuel's face grew larger and larger as the trim, solid house neared completion. Tears streamed down Emmanuel's face as he was handed the keys." Isn't that wonderful? They definitely appreciated what they'd been given. In Matthew 21, Jesus told a story not very different. A story in which tenants were entrusted with a well-built, income-earning property. But there, the outcome was much different. They felt entitled to it, resentful toward the giver. Their attitude was poisoned by eagerness to grab rather than grace. And the story concluded with a shock ending for the listeners. Before we get into the story itself, it helps to understand the context, both Jesus' immediate setting and the larger picture of how things get done by the powerful back then in the Middle East. First, consider Jesus' immediate setting. The forces arrayed against Jesus at this point in his ministry are mounting. John 11:53 reveals that after Christ raised Lazarus from the dead, from that day on, they, the Jewish leaders, plotted to take his life. 4 verses later, we find out the chief priests and Pharisees had given orders that if anyone found out where Jesus was, he should report it so they might arrest him. The warrant was out for his arrest. If you knew where Jesus was, it was your civic duty to report it to the authorities. Friction mounted as Jesus continued to challenge the power brokers. There was the great parade we call the triumphal entry. John notes the crowd was so big partly because they'd heard of the miracle of raising Lazarus from the dead. Then came Jesus' cleansing of the temple, upsetting the tables of the money changers and merchants. Matthew records that the leaders were indignant. Maybe that's sort of upsetting the tables of the merchants and money lenders, maybe a symbol of protest against corporate greed that knows no limits. But Jesus had a couple of factors in his favor. He operated with great secrecy and was very elusive when not teaching the crowds. Also, he enjoyed immense popularity amongst the common folk. Remember, he's in the most wanted category, but nobody's ratting him out. So the leaders couldn't arrest him when he was out in public for fear they'd be mobbed. 21:46. They looked for a way to arrest him, but they were afraid of the crowd because the people held that he was a prophet. 26:5. They plotted to arrest Jesus and kill him, but not during the feast, they said, or there may be a riot among the people. So you get this increasing tension, like an ominous thundercloud of the murderous power brokers following Jesus around, waiting for an opportune moment, trying to catch him in something he might say. Yet there's the opposing force of his great popularity, protecting him as long as he's out in plain view in the public square. Now, step back a bit to the larger context of how business was done in politics in the Middle East back in those days. Tyrants, despots, and emperors ruled. The typical leadership style of rulers back then could best be described as brutal. It doesn't go far enough to just say heavy-handed. Back in 1 Kings 21, King Ahab mirrors the governing paradigm of other kings in his day when he takes possession of Naboth's vineyard. He occupies Naboth's vineyard, as it were. Actually, it's his wife Jezebel who arranges Naboth's trial and murder on false charges of treason. In Jezebel's view, if you're a king, you want it, you take it. To a pining Ahab, feeling constrained by Israel's divinely given law to protect family inheritance and property rights, she blurts, "Is this how you act as king over Israel? I'll get you the vineyard." the only golden rule of Jezebel was she who has the gold makes the rules. So, for Naboth. Or consider a more recent example from just a few decades before Jesus' ministry. After Herod the Great died in 4 BC, there was a bit of a power vacuum in Palestine until the estate got settled by Rome. Riots and rebellion broke out in Jerusalem and the countryside. The Roman governor of neighboring Syria to the north was named Varus. A history book states, as brigandage, terror, and anarchy spread, Varus' response was swift. He took his legions of soldiers and four cavalry troops and marched from the north down to Jerusalem, driving out rebels. When they took one Galilean city named Sepphoris, they sold its inhabitants into slavery and burned the city. Further south, they looted and burned Arras and Sappho. The village of Emmaus, remember Road to Emmaus? The village of Emmaus was burned on Varus' orders. Upon reaching Jerusalem, some 2,000 rebels were crucified. Picture that, 2,000 rebels all on crosses. So, rulers did not take rebellion lightly. It was dealt with quickly and harshly. At least, it seems that's how the Romans managed a successful empire. Now, keep those dynamics in mind as we now hear again the story Jesus told. The context puts some things in a different light. Verse 33, we have the owner's major investment. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a wine press in it, and built a watchtower. Now, don't pass over those too lightly. You've got to buy the place, tear up the soil, get rid of the weeds, buy good vine root stock, choice vines, that's going to run you a dime or two. Plant it and water it, put up a protective wall or hedge, dig a wine press off in a trough out of solid rock. Try digging in solid rock lately. Into which the juice would flow as it was pressed. And build a watchtower shelter, a raised wooden platform rabbis prescribed, a 15 feet high and 6 feet square. I mean, you've got a lot invested there. You've plowed a lot of time and effort and resources into Judean Valley Winery Inc. You want to find the right kind of workers to look after it and bring some profit from it to reward your investment. Now, Jesus' choice of this metaphor should have started ringing some bells for his listeners. Psalm 80 and Isaiah 5, with which we open today's service, both talk of God planting Israel as a choice vine, spread out, flourish, and fill the countryside. So the imagery of a vineyard should have tipped them off he might be referring to them in some way. But they got so drawn into the story, they must have let that thought slip into the background. The landowner planted a vineyard. The question for reflection here. How has God invested in my life? With what gifts and abilities has he entrusted me? Well, it was a promising start for the little vineyard enterprise, but you know how it is in real estate. You have to be choosy about your renters or you can wind up with some real winners. This time, it seems the landowner drew the short straw. We read on. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and went away on a journey. When the harvest time approached, he sent his servants to the tenants to collect his fruit. The tenants seized his servants. They beat one, killed another, and stoned a third. You know, it should have been pretty straightforward. He rented, or leased, the vineyard. That involves some kind of lease agreement, clearly setting forth the terms. So much money or fruit, etc. each year as rent payment. He was clearly owed his share of the crop. Just one problem. No way were these plotters going to ante up. They beat one servant, killed another, stoned another. Ooh. These tenants somehow nurtured a sense of entitlement. They were boldly trying to seize what's not theirs. Occupy the vineyard. A second question for reflection here. Is there evidence that would indicate I ignore God and try to run life my way, making others casualties? Or just kind of steamroll over them when they kind of get in my way? Who might I have inadvertently beaten up in my push to get ahead? Now take a step back here and recall our discussion of context, how business was usually done by landowners and rulers in the ancient world. If something like this was going on, you didn't let it slide. You'd react firmly, quickly. These rebels need to be taught a lesson. The landowner's advisors must have been telling him, you need to make them an example, or your other renters are going to try and pull the same stunt. So, what do? Call in the local soldiers. Kill those who murdered your servants. Maybe their families, too. Burn down their houses. You know, the usual.
We'll get Jezebel on that right away.
But wait. Despite the conventional wisdom his advisors must have been giving him, the landowner takes a different tack. He repeats his attempt to collect what's due him. Verse 36. Then he sent other servants to them, more than the first time, and the tenants treated them the same way. Like, what did he expect? But this highlights the extreme patience of the owner. He didn't write them off with the first trespass, but gave them another chance. Is God patient? 2 Peter 3:9. The Lord is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance. God is love, John tells us. Paul adds that love is patient. Love is kind. It is not easily angered. The landowner's remarkable patience reflects a loving God's patience toward us sinners, giving us a second chance through the good news about Jesus and the cross, not wanting anyone to perish. The last part of verse 33 said the landowner went away on a journey. To many people today, that's where God is, away, not part of the picture. To such folk, it seems safe to ignore, rebel against, or outright disbelieve in Jesus. He has allowed them that space or room in which to choose to rebel. But it's only for a season. As in the story, eventually the landowner returns and judgment happens. Don't presume upon God's patience or you risk terrible judgment for your soul. So after the second batch of would-be rent collector servants are beaten and killed and cut to death with rocks, how does the landowner respond? Does he get it and lower the boom? No. He gives them one more chance and ups the stakes significantly. Verse 37. Last of all, he sent his son to them. They will respect my son, he said. The word in the Greek for respect, I mean have regard for, revere. Now, if you were this man's advisor at this point, would you be in favor of this approach? What? They've already killed two parties of your servants, and now you want to send in your son, the only legal offspring who can carry on the family business? Are you crazy? Have you gone nuts? Send in the police already and scorch the place. So by this time, we're not very surprised at the outcome in verses 38 for the tenants' treasonous opportunism. When the tenants saw the son, they said to each other, this is the heir. Come, let's kill him and take his inheritance. So they took him and threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. Remember that 15-foot-high watchtower the landowner had constructed? You could do some serious damage to somebody by chucking him off that. Not only did they kill the rightful heir, they made a point of doing it shamefully. Threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. Now, if our landowner by this time seems a little clueless, the tenants aren't much brighter. They suppose by killing the heir, they can grab the inheritance. Fat chance. That's what laws and courts and government backed by the sword are for. He's still the landowner. You're still a mere tenant. So in the rebellious tenants, we see the blindness of greed, their unreasoning grabbiness. It makes no sense. A third question to think about here. What welcome do I give the Son? To what degree am I receptive to Jesus' interference in my affairs? Do I receive him or reject him in his rightful claim to my followership? But this climax of the story, projecting out from the immediate landowner to the ultimate almighty owner of all that exists, we're left with this picture of God's lavish, near crazy, ever so patient, unthinkably gracious dealings with us. Crazy love. Just here we see Jesus' masterful construction and telling of the parable is a setup. His listeners have walked right into his drama, maybe especially the chief priests and Pharisees, the religious elite who were very well endowed and property conscious, those who take widows' houses whenever they get a chance, you know. Now, this is long before the day of DVDs with alternate endings, but Jesus allows that option. He pauses and invites the crowd to suggest their own preferred ending to the tale. Verse 40. Therefore, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those tenants? He puts that there as a question. You fill in the blank. No doubt in their minds, with hesitation, as with one voice, the crowd cries out, verse 41. He will bring those wretches to a wretched end. He will rent the vineyard to other tenants who will give him his share of the crop to harvest time. Those terrible tenants who acted so appallingly would finally get their comeuppance. Justice would be served, and it was long overdue. Evil people would endure evil consequences. There was a fittingness to their fate. Talk about a wretched end. Remember the symbolism of the vineyard being Israel in the Old Testament prophetic view? It's estimated some 1.1 million Jews perish in the siege and destruction of Jerusalem at the hand of the Romans in 70 AD. 1.1 million people. Did Jesus wince when they said, wretched end? Although the crowd is supplied what they perceive should be an appropriate ending, Jesus has a surprising, shocking twist awaiting them. Verses 42 to 44, he applies the story to them as if they are the terrible tenants. Verse 43 is strongest. He says, therefore I tell you that the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people who will produce its fruit. A people, ethne, usually referring to the Gentiles. So Paul heard Jesus sending him to the Gentiles, and by the second century, the church was largely composed of non-Jews. Given to others who will produce its fruit, really. Giving the owner his share of the fruit was the goal all along, wasn't it? Verse 34, to collect his fruit. 41, give him his share of the crop. Are you being fruitful for God? Are you stewarding wisely the gifts, the vineyard he's invested into your life? Interestingly, Jesus sandwiches this saying about the kingdom, verse 43, in between two verses about some stone, an image he lifts from Psalm 118, a worship liturgy passage that will be extremely familiar to his listeners. As if the kingdom hinges on what you make of this stone. Verse 41, the builders rejected it. The Lord has made it the head cornerstone. Verse 43, it's like it's a living, dangerous stone. If you fall on it, it will be shattered or broken to pieces. But if it falls on you, you'll be crushed, ground to powder. What is this stone? It must be the rock of reference, the primary reality you have to orient yourself around in life. Daniel interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dream about a statue that was struck and demolished by a rock cut not by human hands. The rock filled the whole earth. Jesus, the living stone, as Peter calls him, supersedes all earth's kingdoms and our temporal construct. He's the ultimate reference point by which our life's goodness or wickedness is judged. The primary question with which people must wrestle is this: what will I do with Jesus? What do you make of him? What do you suppose is going on at the cross, if not the salvation of many sinners? What do you do with that? In a way, Relief and Development Sunday reminds us in the relatively prosperous West that we have been entrusted with much in this vineyard in which we find ourselves. What fruit is God looking for from us? Are we going to be like the terrible tenants who thought they were entitled to the whole package, who refused stubbornly and brutally to yield the landowner his due? Now, most days, we probably don't give much thought to how close to the top of the world's wealth pyramid we actually are, how rich are the resources we take for granted. A Meeting House podcast featuring Krista Hesselink had some statistics that startled me. If you look up on Wikipedia under international inequality, you'll find out some of these stats. For instance, the richest 1% of people in the world receive as much as the bottom 57%. Or in other words, less than 50 million richest people receive as much as 2.7 billion poor people. If you want to look at those right at the top of the heap, the three richest people possess more financial assets than the poorest 10% of the world's population combined. These top three people, as of May 2005, have assets that exceed the combined gross domestic product of the 47 countries with the least GDP. 47 countries, and these three people have more assets. Oh, well, you say, God, those filthy rich people right at the top, I'm nowhere near them. Oh, aren't you now? An American having the average income of the bottom U.S. decile, that is the lowest tenth of the U.S. population, is better off than two-thirds of the world population. You hear this Occupy Wall Street, 99%. We're the 99%. Yeah, you're the 99%, but you're not that bottom 67%. The poorest 10% in the States are above two-thirds of the world. To be a member of the top 10% of world wealth distribution requires about $61,000. I suspect some of us would qualify for that. You've got $61,000, you're in the top 10% of the world wealth distribution. Additionally, the top 10% of adults own 85% of global household wealth. Now, I pulled this off the internet. Look at this one here on the left, and it's hard to make out the wording, but it's basically, these are one-fifth slices of the world's population, and the top fifth have, I think it says, 82.7% of resources there. This is, now look at the date here, 1992. And now, in 2005, the stat is the top 10% of adults own 85%. So, instead of the top 20%, it's gone up to the top 10%. So, what's happened? The rich have got richer. The disparity has increased. So, that means the other 15% of global household wealth has to be spread out amongst the remaining 90% of the world's people. Quite a contrast, quite a disparity. Did you know you were so close to the top 10%? Are we fruitful, reliable tenants? Or grabby, rebellious, possessive ones, presuming we're entitled to it all? In the biblical view, when we help the poor, we lend to God and honor God. Consider these verses, Proverbs 14:31. He who oppresses the poor shows contempt for their maker, but whoever is kind to the needy honors God. 19:17. He who is kind to the poor lends to the Lord. Isn't that kind of a deep thought? You lend to God by being kind to the poor. And he will reward him for what he has done. And Jesus' own account of the king judging between the sheep and the goats. What was the one big difference? The king will reply to the sheep, I tell you the truth, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me. For the goats it was, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do it for me. It's interesting, watching the stream on live stream Occupy NYC. You got all this chatter going along on the right-hand side of the page. Anyway, one of the little chat lines was, I thought I saw Jesus in the crowd. That just kind of makes you stop and think, where would Jesus be in this picture? The Lord calls us to guard against the grabby greed of the rebellious tenants and instead lavish crazy love like the patient, nutty landowner. We close today with a video from the Homes for Haiti project accompanied by Matt Maher's song, Hold Us Together. It's what he's talking about in the song at first. It's kind of hard to make out in the lyrics at first, but it's love won't pay your bills. It won't make everything right, and it's not easy to solve your life in 5 easy steps. But love will hold us together.